Thanks for listening to the Herd Podcast. Be sure to catch us live every weekday from 12 to 3 Eastern, 9 to noon Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and FS1. Find your local station for the Herd at foxsportsradio.com or stream us live every day on the iHeartRadio app by searching Herd.
Now let's get this party started.
You're listening to Fox Sports Radio.
The new book is Three Ring Circus. And what's great about dynasties in sports is they never get old. They just don't. You can read about dysfunction on dynasties. I just read a Patriots book, and it's like it's just incredible. I just can't get enough on dynasties. And obviously the Shaq, Kobe, Jerry West, Phil Jackson, a lot of egos, a lot of greatness, and Jeff Perlman, Three Ring Circus. The book is now out, and he is joining us live. So, you know, it's funny, Jeff. Usually dysfunction punctures momentum. And Kobe and Shaq, I mean, different backgrounds, a lot of dysfunction, but they made it work for quite a while. How did they make it work?
I mean, the number one thing is they had two of the most of the five most talented guys on the court at all times. And that's a huge thing. That's a huge thing. I just think they chose to coexist. Not lovingly, but they chose to coexist. And I really think what the Lakers did, the most important thing they did, is they always had these role players who doubled as almost like guidance counselors. So whether it was Derek Harper, Rick Fox, J.R. Reed, John Sally, you know, on and on, Ron Harper, there are always guys who are there to kind of smooth things over in the locker room. Brian Shaw, guys like that. And it just made a world of difference. So even though it's funny because Shaq and Kobe occupied their own orbits in that locker room. And the media would go to Shaq, and he would say something about Kobe. And then they would go to Kobe. And it was the most passive-aggressive nonsense ever. Truly ludicrous. But these guys, these veterans, were all able to handle it well and sort of work it out so it was okay. It wasn't that big a deal. And also, Phil Jackson, to his credit, like when Kurt Rambis was the interim coach, Shaq's big complaint was he needs to stop babying Kobe. He needs to stop babying Kobe. And Phil Jackson didn't baby Kobe. He kind of let it be. He let these guys run the locker room, and it kind of worked.
So I remember when Shaq was in college. In fact, I talked to Jerry Tarkanian. I was in Vegas, and he told me about Shaq. He said, there's a kid down in Louisiana. He's going to change the game. But Kobe was different. He grew up in Italy. He was a high school player. We didn't know much about him. I mean, literally, we it wasn't a time when you drafted a guard out of high school, okay? So
yeah.
Jerry, you don't think about it as a risk, but Jerry West drafts a high schooler, makes a trade with Charlotte. Was there any misgivings? Was he nervous? Was there any doubt for Jerry West with Kobe when he's 18?
All right, so it's the best thing ever. So it's all John Calipari's fault. It's all John Calipari's fault. So John Calipari is a coach in the Nets. He's a young coach, first year. And they have decided they are going to draft Kobe Bryant with the 8th pick in the 96 draft. It is a lock. That is who we are drafting. And John Nash is the general manager. They're all on board. They've brought Kobe in 4 times. They love him. Leading up to the draft, they actually meet with Kobe's parents. And they're like, we're going to draft your son. And Joe and Pam Bryant are like, that's great. He'll be nearby. Day before the draft, Kobe Bryant calls John Calipari on his own and says, I want to get away from my family. I don't want to play in New Jersey. I don't want you to draft me. Kobe's agent calls John Calipari and says, yeah, if you guys draft Kobe, he probably won't play this year or he might go to Italy. Calipari's freaking out. He's like, oh my God. He goes to John Nash, the GM. He's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. What are we going to do? John Nash, you need to calm down. It's all just a bluff. It's just a bluff. Kerry Kittles out of Villanova is represented by David Falk. David Falk calls John Calipari and says, Kerry really wants to play with you guys. If you don't draft him, if he's there, I'm never going to have a player go to you again. Calipari is freaking out. He goes into John Nash. John, I don't know what we're going to do. John Nash is like, Cal, you need to calm down. It's all just a bluff. And behind the scenes, there's this whole mechanism to get Kobe to LA because he already signed a deal with Adidas. They don't want him playing in the swamps in New Jersey. They want him in LA. Jerry West is friends with Kobe's agent, Arne Tellem. And John Nash is telling Cal, we got to do this. We got to do this. We have to draft him. He's going to change the franchise. It's a day morning of the draft. John Calipari, who has in his contract his final personnel say, gathers everyone around, and he says, I've made a decision. If Kerry Kittles is there at number eight, we're going to take Kerry Kittles. And if he's not there, we're going to take Kobe Bryant. And John Nash just does one of those and puts his hands in his head. Of course, Kerry Kittles is there at number eight. I talked to Kittles. Kittles was like, I played with Kobe in the summer. I would have drafted Kobe too. They end up drafting Kerry Kittles. Jerry West is doing a freaking dance in his office because he knows the next four picks are not going to be Kobe Bryant. He has his deal worked out with Charlotte, and he ends up trading Vlade for the rights of Kobe. And he says to Jerry Buss, right after that happens, I just got you the best player in this draft, because they had worked out Kobe twice, once against Michael Cooper, once against Dante Jones, and it was the best two workouts Jerry West had ever seen.
Wow. How about that? You know, when you do these books, I mean, again, it's scuba gear. You deep dive. There's always a crazy story. You have to find, I mean, you have hundreds of sources per book. Was there a crazy, who did you track down that was crazy? What was the craziest story in the book?
I mean, my favorite track down, I love the track downs. And J.R. Ryder, you know, he was a Laker for 1 year. People forget J.R. Yeah. Ryder was a Laker for 1 year, former slam dunk champ. So J.R. Ryder, who I love, I actually really love. He, twice in his career, when writers wrote something that he did not like, actually said to them, I know where your family lives. Oh, like, that was his threat to them. I know where your family lives. All I had was an address for J.R. Ryder. I did not have a phone number. And I was going to be in Arizona. So I decided I'm going to drive to J.R. Ryder's house. And I drive out there. I get there at like 9:30, which is a little early, but that's okay. I knock on the door. A kid answers. I have my USFL book with me. I'm like, hey, is J.R. Ryder here? He's like, hold on. A woman comes to the door. I'm like, hey, my name's Jeff Perlman. I'm a writer. Is J.R. Ryder here? She goes, hold on. They close the door. I hear her and a guy, adult male, yelling at each other. And then the door opens and there's J.R. Ryder. And he goes, who are you? And I'm like, hey, my name's Jeff Perlman and I'm a writer and I'm doing a book about the... Bro, are you effing kidding me? Bro, you just knock on my door. Are you kidding me? He opens the door and comes out and he's like this far away from me. And he's like, bro, that is not cool. And I'm convinced at this moment I'm about to get punched by J.R. Ryder. And he goes, what's that book you have? And I'm like, oh, it's a book I did about the USFL. And is that Trump? I'm like, yeah, Trump owned a team. What are you working on? I'm like, well, I'm doing a book about the Lakers during the Shaq Kobe years. All right, man, I'll talk to you. Ends up giving me 2 hours.
Wow.
J.R. Ryder. And he was awesome. And I just want to say the best story ever is J.R. Ryder's playing for the Lakers and they're on the road and he oversleeps. And he asked the front desk clerk to write him a note to give to Phil Jackson explaining that he did not get a wake-up call. So literally J.R. Ryder arrives at practice and gives Phil Jackson a note, like a student late for class, that says, Dear Coach Jackson, we are sorry on behalf of whatever hotel was the Hyatt. We regret that we were unable to provide J.R. Ryder with the requisite wake-up call. It is our fault. And he gives it to Phil Jackson as his excuse for not being on practice on time.
These are the kind of stories you get. It's a great book. It's called Three Ring Circus with Jeff Perlman. You know, it's when you read the book, Shaq and Magic Johnson has this quality too. Magic likes you to ask for help. Like if Magic's offended if you move to LA and don't ask him for help. And yep. I think Shaq wanted to be a little bit of a father figure for Kobe, right? Like not only the physical stature he was so big, but you know he went to college, and but it didn't work that way. And why? Tell the audience why? Because I think Shaq wanted that and would have been comfortable with that, but it didn't work that way.
I talked to a guy named Mike Penberthy. Do you remember Mike Penberthy?
Yes, I know. Yes, I do.
He was he played with the Lakers for a spell for a year, and he went to Masters College. And he told me when he first got to the Lakers, he made the team, and he didn't have a suit. He only had a jacket he bought at Nordstrom's off the rack. And Shaq sees him wearing this jacket, and he says, Mike, do you own any suits? And Penberthy's like, I don't. Shaq's like, tomorrow, meet me here. And he brings his personal suit maker, his outfitter, and he pays for 6 of Mike Penberthy's suits.
Wow. Yeah.
When Shaq was teammates with Mark Madsen, he would go around and ask women if they were Mormon and if they were single so he could introduce them to Mark Madsen, who was Mormon and single. Like, he would fly people in the parents of teammates in to see their kid's first game in the NBA. He would pay for the funerals of teammates' parents. He was, Penberthy said to me, he's the best teammate who's ever existed, just the best teammate who ever existed. And that's what he wanted to be, to his credit. He just wanted to be that. And Kobe comes along, and Kobe's first introduction to the Lakers is first training camp in Hawaii. Dale Harris is a coach. All the players gather around, and they introduce each other. So it's like, hey, I'm Nick Van Exel. I'm Eddie Jones. I'm Kobe Bryant. I played at Lower Merion last year, and nobody here is going to punk me. Like, that was his introduction to Lakers. Nobody here is going to punk me. He's 18 years old. And Kobe just wants him to say, can we go out to dinner? Can you help me with this? I don't understand this. And it just wasn't who he was. And Kobe had, Shaq kind of had this thing in his head. I'm Batman. Kobe's going to be Robin. I'm Big Brother. He's going to be Little Brother. But it just wasn't who Kobe Bryant was. And you're right. You are 100% right. The Magic Shaq comparison is a really good one. He just wanted you to ask, and he just wanted to be loved. And Kobe was not someone who did that.
By the way, Jeff adds a prologue to the book. The book had been written when Kobe passed, so he adds some texture and context to that as well. It's in the book. The book is called Three Ring Circus. What I love about this stuff, there's a shot of the book. You know, it's interesting now that LeBron's in town. The Lakers are a fascinating legacy. You've had, there was kind of the flaky Wilt into the sort of academic prickly Kareem, into everybody loves Magic, into bigger than life Shaq. And then there was, there's Magic. And then there's kind of the aloof prodigy Kobe. And now it's LeBron. And I know, you know, you're not writing a book with LeBron in mind, but I love your take on this, is that what's fascinating about the Lakers dynasty is all these superstars have been unique. They're all just, I mean, there is a Magic Shaq thing that's kind of similar, but yes. You're kind of feeling on how the Laker, if the Lakers won the title, Jeff, how Kobe and Magic were so deeply embedded into the lore of the franchise. You know, here comes LeBron moving into town. He's already won titles. If he wins, what does it mean for the Lakers? How much of a Laker is LeBron, in your opinion?
It's so funny. I have a 20-year-old nephew named Jordan, and he's always like, LeBron is the greatest Laker ever, right? And he's like, no, what are you talking about? You know, no. I feel like in history, we're always going to think of LeBron first and foremost for Cleveland.
Yes.
I just think it's a guarantee, and that's what it is. And I feel like that's the big difference here, is that when you think of Kobe, he's a Laker. When you think of Magic, he's a Laker. Even Shaq with the 4 years in Orlando, he's a Laker. Will Chamberlain, who played in Philly, a Laker. Jerry West, a Laker. And I do think the big difference here is his legacy will be great. He'll have brought the Lakers a title. It's wonderful. I just don't think he goes down the same way, because I don't think he will be thought of as a Laker, a career Laker. And I think here in LA, that really means something. Not just that you played here, but that you, like Kobe, when he died, I'm a native New Yorker. I've lived here for 6 years. The thing that just did it for me and shocked me is how much people felt that death. And they felt like he was, it wasn't just a star dying. It was an icon dying. It was a part of LA dying.
Yes.
And I'm not sure if LeBron has that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, I think you're totally right. When Kobe passed away, as somebody that lives in Los Angeles, I was in an airport. I just landed. I literally was sick to my stomach. I went to the back of a restaurant. It was very emotional. Like I felt like Los Angeles lost something. He was so Los Angeles. It's very much, it feels Troy Aikman, Dallas. Like Aikman, he sounds like he's from Dallas. He looks like he's from Dallas. He is Dallas. And I'm with you. I think LeBron is remarkable, but the depth of that relationship with fans, speaking of depth, the book is called Three Ring Circus. There's dozens of stories. Jeff writes a book every couple years. We bring him on, strongly recommend it. And boy, I'll tell you, it's a dynasty with egos and stories and conflict, and you get all of it there. Jeff, it's great talking to you again. I haven't seen you in a while. Keep safe for you and your fam, your kids and your wife, and continued success.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure being here. I appreciate it.
The book is out.
This is the Herd Best Of. Coming up next, Jim Gray. Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, FS1, and the iHeartRadio app.
It's not about zoo animals. It's about the greatest athletes of all time. Jim's first interview, he was 18 years old. was Muhammad Ali, who was the biggest star in the world. He is now joining us live, and we appreciate that. All right, how'd you get Muhammad Ali at 18 years old? What's the secret sauce to that, Jimbo?
Hey, Colin, thanks for having me. Well, I was a sports intern for the ABC station in Denver, KBTV, and my internship expired, and they were converting from film to videotape. So all the union guys took the buyout, and so a bunch of people who didn't really have any idea what they were doing became videotape editors. I was in my edit room one morning very early getting ready for the draft, a Red Miller show. He was the Broncos coach. Lady named Sue Tews, the assignment editor, came running in. She said, Muhammad Ali's 2.5 hours early at the airport. Run out and get him. Well, Ali was getting ready to fight Spinks, and then he was going to fight a Denver Bronco named Lyle Alzado. Well, I'd never done an interview before, so I went into the weatherman's office, tried to find a coat and tie, couldn't find anything, went out to Stapleton International Airport, did the interview with Ali. After the first question, he said, you're the one that's doing this interview? And everybody started to laugh. Well, Colin, that just made me feel so much more comfortable, because I had gone from nervous about interviewing the most visible and famous person on the planet to now they were laughing. But they weren't laughing at me. They were you know, laughing to make me comfortable, the whole entourage. And so after the third or fourth question, he said, you sound like the local Howard Cosell. Colin, that was the greatest compliment I had ever had in my life. And it gave me so much confidence. I took the interview back to the station. The news director was a man named Roger Ogden for ABC there. He looked at the tape, and he was with me for about 45 minutes, and he looked at it again, and he said, huh, we're going to put you in this tape on the air. It's barely adequate. So I tell everybody I've been barely adequate ever since.
The only athlete that rivals him in terms of flair and greatness, Muhammad Ali, is Michael Jordan. They're both, like, great-looking, stylish, thoughtful, smart. What was it like to interview Jordan?
He was always impeccable. I mean, I never once saw Michael have a bad public moment. He always was great. He'd pat every youngster on the head. You know, when he'd walk out of the building, you know, back when there was proximity, he'd sign autographs. He was nice to the security people. So interviewing him, Michael was just, you know, easy. He was easy to talk to. He was easy to be around. I know his teammates in The Last Dance have a different portrayal, but in terms of how he was with me and with the media, he was great. And he was just terrific in all those years that we had him on NBC and, you know, in the pregame meetings where he would come in and Marv or Ahmad would interview him. He was just a perfect gentleman. And then a few times that I got to be with him outside of the court in Barcelona, we played golf on a few occasions, and he was just great. There was nothing intimidating off the court about Michael Jordan.
What about, here's somebody that's interesting, Mike Tyson. You interviewed him after the bizarre ear-biting Evander experience. Now that had to be odd, right?
That was quite odd, and that was one that I knew when it was going to happen after he bit the ear, that nothing like this would ever happen again. And you know, he left the ring and didn't talk in the ring, and we went back underneath. I was working with Showtime, where I still do the boxing, and David Dinkins, who is the producer, was in my ear, and he said, see if you can get Don to get him to come out. So Don King brought him out. And Colin, it's the only time that I have ever seen actually somebody who is alive, and I could see their skull. That's how deep over his eye the headbutt was, and the wound that had opened. Wow. You could see the orbital bone in his skull. And that's why he felt he had to bite Evander Holyfield. That was the reasoning he had, that he had to retaliate. So we did the interview, and I took it in chronological order and asked him what had gone on. And finally, well, was that the proper response to bite his ear? And he answered the question. And I've always had tremendous respect and admiration for Mike Tyson, because at his worst moments, and he's had some bad, despicable moments, at his worst moments, Colin, he always had the wherewithal to stand there and answer the questions. He didn't hide behind some PR person.
Yeah.
He didn't come out with a statement 4 days later. He stood there and he took his medicine and he gave you a response. And that's very, very rare.
Were you surprised the pushback? I certainly was. The LeBron decision interview created. I still can't figure out why the nation imploded. I thought LeBron looked nervous and thoughtful. Were you shocked by kind of the national response and the anger at LeBron?
Yes, I was, and like Rich Paul has said to me and Maverick Carter, none of us had a crystal ball. None of us could foresee what went on there. And could we have been more sensitive to the fans in Cleveland? Absolutely. And could we have explained better that we were giving away millions upon millions of dollars, the biggest donation ever in the history of the Boys and Girls Club? Yes, wow. We could have. Wow. So yes, we could have done better, but to make LeBron into a villain, it was wrong then, and it should have never occurred. And if you look at that show now and what the decision has become, that was the moment. It was the Curt Flood moment for this generation of player empowerment and of the birth, really, of communicating through social media and the rise of the Players Tribune and just how things go now, the reverberations of that show and the passage of time, the NBA players and all of sports, every player in sports owes a tremendous debt of gratitude to LeBron James.
Talking to GOATs. Now, we know you've done Tiger and we know you've done Brady, and I'm going to save those for people to buy the book because I want an autographed copy as well. But I got to ask you this. I remember interviewing Charles Barkley when I was a local reporter, and I knew he was going to be a star. He was so funny. He made fun of my shoes. He made fun of me. You just knew. You're like, that guy's going to be hysterical on TV. Is there anybody that's not a star that you interviewed and you just loved? You just went home and, you know, that maybe we wouldn't talk about, or maybe a lower star, or somebody perhaps you haven't interviewed you want to?
Well, you know, Charles was great. And I say in the book that Charles was the most entertaining, most fun guy to be around. And we used to go up and down the Ramblas at night in Barcelona at the Olympics, and then hung out with him a tremendous amount. And Mike Tyson threatened to kill me on the air. And 45 seconds later, he kissed me on the cheek. And I'm still trying to figure out what's more disturbing. Charles Barkley kissed me on my cheek twice on national television. And for no apparent reason, at least Mike was trying to make up for threatening to kill me.
Yeah.
Charles did it, and I still don't know why he did it. But to answer your question, I mean, there's a lot of guys who I've walked away and I thought, you know, that's what a pleasant, really great guy. And, you know, they're superstars too. I mean, Brady is as nice a guy and as cordial as anybody you'd ever want to meet. Wayne Gretzky, Julius Irving, Joe Namath. I don't know anybody who's more comfortable, who's been a bigger superstar, who forced a merger of a league and brought the AFL to this Super Bowl that we now see, than Joe Namath. So, and a guy who was really understated, but who had just an incredible heart and really didn't seek the limelight or anything. I love spending time around marvelous Marvin Hagler. He was really special, Colin.
Oh, yeah. You know, my first job, I don't want to waste time here. My first job at a college was covering boxing. So instead of going to your usual first job in Midland, Texas, I got to cover Hagler, Sugar Ray Leonard, and I've always thought of it as the great career break. Now, I made about $8 an hour, and I lived on peanut brittle. But both of us started basically for free. The book is called Talking to Goats. Buy it. I want a copy. This is just great. Jim, absolute pleasure. The Emmy-winning sports reporter, sportscaster of the year in America in 1997. Great seeing you, and thanks for stopping by our show.
Colin, thanks for having me. Love your show. Appreciate it. Talk to you soon.
All right.
This is the Herd Best Of. Coming up next, P.J. Fleck.
P.J. Fleck, the hot young college football coach, one of the really interesting, fascinating guys in the sport, joins us. Fourth year at Minnesota, 23-15. So let's, you know, it's funny. When I watch you, you got a lot of energy. You are just jumping through my television set. And I think to myself, who is this guy's mentor? Who is his idol? Who was your guy? Were you a Bo? Were you a Woody? Where did you get the inspiration? When you get to a dark time in your life and you know that you lose a recruit, you lose a game, who do you go back to? Who's PJ Fleck's mentor in this stuff?
That's a great question, Colin. Well, first of all, you got to know that I was an elementary school teacher and have an elementary education degree before I even got into professional football, and then obviously get into coaching. But it really dates back to a few guys. Jim Tressel's really the guy that first took a chance on me. And I was a GA at Ohio State during the 2006 run where we lost to Florida in the national championship. And I still remember going through that year going, boy, this coaching thing is not that hard. I mean, you show up, you're coaching, you're undefeated, you play in the game of the century, you win, and then you go get beat by Florida. But there were so many lessons Coach Tressel taught me of how to care for the complete person in this profession, not just the football player, but academically, athletically, socially, and spiritually. And then when you look at Mike Nolan, who was my head coach when I played for the San Francisco 49ers, who also thought that I should be able to get into coaching. And if it wasn't for those two guys, I wouldn't be where I am today. And then Greg Schiano kind of helped me with college and in the pros. And here we are today.
You know, one of the reasons, I don't know much about COVID, I wear a mask, but the one thing I said that I was rooting for college football is there is no Joe Burrow if he didn't play last year. He probably goes undrafted. That you often recruit young men who come from tough environments. You can literally change their life. And if we would not have played college football, let's be honest, after about 20 guys, PJ, in the first round of the draft, most of these guys played their way into getting drafted in the second, third, fourth round. You literally can change lives. And there was a point a month ago, we didn't know 3 weeks ago we were going to have Big Ten football. How was it landing for you that you want to be respectful to COVID and the dangers of it, but no football, there's a lot of kids that need it.
Well, there's a lot of kids that need it. You know, this is their way to be able to, one, get an education paid for, one, get a bachelor's, sometimes get a master's. We have some kids getting their doctorate degree that if it wasn't for football, they wouldn't have those opportunities. But we've stressed to our team, we're a proactive football team, not a reactive football team. This isn't about just because COVID-19 came up. You have to have contingency plans upon contingency plans in all areas of these young people's lives. I mean, here they are, the one normal thing they've all had in their life that they all been able to schedule their whole life around was football. Then football was taken away from them. They left us for 3-4 months. And then you get them all back together. You're playing, you're not playing, you're playing, you're not playing. And by the way, there's a national pandemic going on with testing and everything else that we have. So it really is, I'm really thankful that we do have football back in the mix, but I'm even more thankful because it's a safe environment for our young people to be in as they continue to play football and go towards their dreams of playing in the National Football League as well or in the professional world.
You're two-time MAC-10, MAC Coach of the Year, Big Ten Coach of the Year, and this is not meant, I'm asking this respectfully because you're an unbelievable coach, but have you ever looked across the sideline as a young coach and thought, I'm coaching against Urban Meyer. I'm coaching against Jim Harbaugh. You know, this a guy that was in the Super Bowl. Have you ever had one of those moments as a young coach and thought, I am in the Big Ten. I'm on national television. I mean, 6 years ago, PJ, that may have been a dream. You're living a life a young coach mostly never gets to.
Well, I am living my dream. I tell our team that all the time and our staff. My job as a coach is to make everybody else's dreams come true because mine has already come true. I don't come from a long line of lineage of coaches. My dad killed bugs for a living. My mom's a teacher's aide. We had no coaching in our background. It was all about education. My sister's a kindergarten teacher. My mom was a special education assistant. And I got into the elementary school teaching, really ancient Rome on that side is where I have a specialty. So when you start to think about how I got started and where I was, I'm incredibly thankful for everything that I've been able to get. But I've looked across in the MAC, looking at Frank Solich. These people had no idea probably who I even was at 31, 32 years old in the MAC, getting a chance to coach against Urban Meyer. When I was at Western Michigan. And even when we get to Minnesota, you're across from James Franklin, who I think is one of the best coaches in America. You get a chance to be against Gus Malzahn and the Outback Bowl and be able to coach against those guys. And for someone who comes not from the coaching tree of so many others, I take a lot of pride into who raised me in the profession. You know, I wear a tie on the sideline, not for me, not to be looked at, but because Mike Nolan wore a tie on the sideline, who's one of my biggest influences. And then Jim Tressel wore a tie on the sideline, who's my biggest influences. And it's my way to be able to thank every single person who made me me. Because if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be in the position that I am. And they put me in those positions. And I think not even just looking across the sideline. I remember when I was at GA at Ohio State, looking next to me and seeing Jim Tressel saying, I'm actually on this guy's staff. It's always been fun. I'm very appreciative for where I am. And I have an amazing staff around me. That are able to make the success possible at times.
So it's interesting, and I had said you. When I remember years and years. I mean, I'm dating myself, but I remember when Urban Meyer went to Utah, and Oregon. He beat Oregon and Cal. Utah did, and Oregon was pretty good. They had Mike Bellotti. They were winning games, and I remember telling my friends. I said, I don't know who this guy is with a different name, but that dude can coach. He's got two-star players, and he's beaten people with three- and four-star players. So you have now twice gone into a program and very quickly turned it around. And this is really a business question as much as it is a football question. So when you go into a culture like Minnesota football that didn't have, you know, that's not Alabama. Give me two things. How do you turn around a business that doesn't have a winning culture? And not only did you do it, you did it quickly.
Yeah, two things. One, you never sacrifice what you really want down the road for what you want immediately right now. That's very difficult to do in our profession. We've won where we've been because we've done it with a lot of high school players. We've played and have been in year twos of programs where we're the youngest team in America, but it was necessary to have the success down the road. And the second thing is you win with people, period. We don't get all the four-star, five-stars. I think in the Auburn game, they had 54 stars and we had five. but we have we call ourselves How University. And it's the how of a person that makes them really special. It's their heart. It's their spirit. It's their unconquerable will. It's their crack on the shoulder, not just a little chip. It's finding a way to constantly give your people an advantage, being proactive, and really getting yourself around a really positive environment where you can find a way to be able to grow in that environment every single day, fail, grow, and want to come back the next day to do it all over again. So that's what we've been able to do, but people is the biggest thing. We have incredible people inside our organization. We have an incredible culture with our row the boat culture, our never give up mantra. And again, it might be a little bit different. It might be maybe not what everybody does, but it's our way. And it's the only way I know. And we're really happy with where we're at and where our program's headed as well.
PJ Fleck, Minnesota football coach. By the way, you said your dad killed bugs. Give me a little more on that. What's that story there?
Terminix. He was a Terminix man. It's, you know, he went there and made sure you didn't have all those creepy crawlers in your house. He worked for AT&T prior to that, too. So he did a lot of things. He's a hardworking man, blue collar.
I love that. I love your story. I think your energy's infectious. You're incredibly easy to root for. Okay, folks, their season starts. They're hosting Michigan. That's about 30 days from now, right? At home against Michigan in 30 days. They were 11-2 last year. They beat Auburn in the out. Love it. So easy to root for. PJ, congrats to you. Continued success to you and your staff and your kids.
Callum, appreciate it, man. Row the boat, Sky Imago, Gophers.
This is the Herd Best Of. Coming up next, Max Crosby. Be sure to catch live editions of The Herd weekdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific.
And he's from, like, Rochester, Michigan. So you would think, oh, he played for Michigan. No, they didn't recruit him. Oh, Michigan State. No, they didn't recruit him. He goes to Eastern Michigan, and he's the best defensive lineman for the Raiders. And his stats are fantastic. They forced five turnovers. And he's in Vegas, baby. And we love Vegas on this show. Max Crosby, Raiders defensive end, is joining us live from Vegas. So, good Lord. First of all, it's great to have you on. And, I'm sitting there thinking, nobody offered you. So how many offers did you get out of high school?
I had one. It was Eastern Michigan. It's funny. Being from Michigan, you know, I would think somebody would want me, but I didn't get anybody. So, you know, Eastern was the only one, and, you know, they offered me, and I was expecting maybe some more offers, but, you know, they were the only one, so I committed right away.
You know, it feels like, honestly, Max, Gruden and the Raiders are a good fit for you and your personality. And I'm not there every day. But give me your relationship with Gruden. I mean, Gruden's a tough guy, and he's a fighter, and you're obviously a fighter to go to Eastern Michigan and end up as a great NFL player. What is Gruden like to play for?
Yeah, you know, I think you're spot on. You know, Oakland, you know, now the Las Vegas Raiders are, you know, it's just a perfect fit for me and my personality. You know, we're hard-nosed, you know, and Gruden loves guys like that. You know, he wants guys that love football, and, you know, that's everything I am. You know, it's an awesome, you know, organization. You know, it's fun, and we have a lot of fun, and it's laid back. But when it's time to work, you know, they're on it. You know, they push me personally every day to my limits, and you know, I know they do that with everybody else. So it's an awesome environment to be around, and we're really just having fun and trying to be the best we can be.
Well, you're winning, and that's all I know. In your, by the way, you're kind of a power football team. You run the ball, you get after it. Now, Vegas can be distracting. As a young guy from cold weather Michigan, and you got a beautiful girlfriend, and you go to Vegas, do you go to the casinos ever? You all football? I mean, what's it like to live there for a young guy?
Yeah, you know, it's I moved here in February, so you know, I kind of got to see the town for the first time, and it was, you know, it was awesome. You know, it's beautiful. There's a lot going on all the time, but for me personally, you know, especially with this COVID going on and everybody's got to be safe and nobody wants to miss games, you know, I literally have the same routine every day. You know, I come home, I eat good, I hang out with the dogs and my girl, and we just relax, you know. So it's not like I'm living on the strip, you know. I'm far away from that, so I'm definitely ducked off and just, you know, having a good time and relaxing.
So you're in a division now with Justin Herbert, Patrick Mahomes. When you guys beat, and nobody else is doing this, you beat the Kansas City Chiefs. Take me inside a little bit what it is like to play with Mahomes. Is he talkative? Does he audible a lot? Is he a trash talker? What is it like to face Mahomes, the world's best football player, many believe now?
Yeah, you know, I believe that too. You know, he's a once in a lifetime type talent. You know, the guy, he doesn't really talk much. You know, he's super focused when he's on the field, but the way he plays is just so much different than any other quarterback you face. It's just like when you play the Chiefs, you know, it's not like a regular football game. You know, you know you're going to be running for your life trying to get him down. You know, he's trying to extend plays, trying to make, you know, underneath passes, behind the back. He'll literally do anything. So he's just he's a different type of player. And, you know, every time we play KC, we know it's going to be a crazy game.
So last time you beat him, and I thought this story was hysterically funny. It's so Raiders. It's so Gruden. It's perfect. So you guys drive the bus around the victory lap thing, and Gruden, it's so funny. So Gruden was asked about it yesterday. I got to play this by of Gruden getting all pissy. Here's Gruden yesterday at the press conference. Here he is.
Hey, John. Today, Andrew Reid mentioned a couple times the victory lap you guys took in KC after the first game. What exactly was the victory lap, and is that something that you think about this week as far as bulletin board material or anything like that?
Not really. I mean, you could find a smart aleck bus driver in Kansas City who made some snide comments when we got on the bus. Maybe that's why we drove around the stadium, just to tick him off. You know, this is ridiculous. Next question.
I mean, come on. So can you just – you won't get in trouble. What happened? Can you tell me the story?
I honestly – it's funny. After the game, you know, we were all so fired up. You know, obviously winning in KC is very rare, and especially with that team, you know, it's a big deal anytime you beat them. So on the bus, you know, I noticed when we took off, we were – like, I didn't even – nobody said anything like, yeah, we're taking a victory lap, blah, blah, blah. I just noticed we were driving around the stadium because we were just going in a big circle. So honestly, a lot of the guys, we had no idea. So we were just – we were just noticing, we're like, wait, like, where are we going? It's just going in circles. So I don't know. You know, I honestly don't know the backstory at all. And, yeah, you know, it is what it is. People are trying to make it bigger than it is.
Yeah, the media, that's what we do. So you have 16 sacks in 25 games. You're a very, you know, you're an emotional guy. You get after it. Can a defensive lineman be a leader? And by the way, when you're young, I mean, you're a kid still in this league. Is it okay? Like, do you like the leadership thing?
Yeah, you know, absolutely. You know, a D lineman definitely could be a leader. You know, we're in the trenches. You know, we're going toe-to-toe with the biggest guys and strongest dudes on the field at all times. So, you know, being a young guy, you know, I feel like that was something I struggled with a little bit last year, you know, as far as a leadership standpoint. But this year, you know, me and Cleland and the rest of the guys, you know, our defense is a bunch of young guys trying to, you know, generate, you know, pressure and generate a new type of football that, you know, is just hard nosed and gritty and play to the end of the whistle. And that's, you know, that's something I'm trying to do, you know, be a part of that and help the guys any way I can.
Boy, your speed is incredible. You just don't play like most defensive linemen. You're fast. Has there been, obviously, you know, it's funny, you play at Eastern Michigan. That's nothing against the league you were in, but the offensive linemen aren't quite as good as the AFC West. Who has been the best offensive lineman you faced?
Ooh, that's tough. In the last 2 years, you know, I feel like David Bakhtiari is definitely up there. We played him in Green Bay last year. I think Taylor Lewan, Laramie Tunsil. There's just a bunch of guys I can name, but. Yeah, no, you're not wrong when you say that. You know, there's every week, you know, that's the biggest difference. Come from the NFL to college. It's like college, you know who you're playing this week. Like, oh, it's about to be one of those weeks. But in the NFL, everybody's good. And there's guys that are athletic, that are 320 pounds and 6'7". Like, you just don't see that in the back. So, you know, the talent is incredible in this league. So it's always awesome, you know, to get up for a challenge like that.
Were you worried a little bit when you came from a smaller school? Take me to your first practice, because, you know, you're Eastern Michigan, you go to the NFL first practice. Was there a moment, Max, when you're like, okay, I can play in this league? I know I can play in this league.
Yeah, 100%. You know, coming from the MAC, you know, we always played like a Kentucky or like an Illinois or Purdue during the season. So I always had big games against the Power Five team. So I was confident, you know, I wasn't worried. But when I first came to training camp, I saw Trent Brown lined up at right tackle and nobody wanted to go against him. And I was like, I'm going to take it on, you know, as a challenge, you know, to try to beat him. If I could beat him one time, I know I can win in this league. So I was going against him every single day. And this dude is 6'8", 6'9", 400 pounds. He's a different, different animal that I've ever gone against. So the first time I beat him, I was like, okay, I can do this. Like, this is easy. If I can beat Trent, I can beat anybody. So that's always been my mentality. I always think about going against Trent when I first got in the NFL. And, you know, that gives me a ton of confidence.
Well, it's great meeting you. The Raiders are a great story. I'm old enough, and I still think I'm pretty young, but I go back to the Raiders when they had Kenny Stabler and John Madden. It's an incredible tradition. Vegas is a perfect fit. And I think the whole John Gruden thing is just, by the way, when they drafted you, did Gruden get on the phone? Max, it's Gruden. Did he get on the phone when he drafted you?
Oh yeah, 100%. The first thing he said is, I need you to get Mahomes. We need you to get Phillip Rivers and all that. And I was like, all right, let's go. I was like, I got this. Let's do it. And it was hilarious. So you know how Gruden is. He always loves challenging his players, and I love it. You know, he's one of a kind.
Easy guy to root for. Max, good luck to you and the Raiders, my friend. Thanks for coming on the show. Good luck to you, your girlfriend, your three dogs, which you locked up for 5 minutes so we could hear you on the air. We appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
All right, Max Crosby, Raiders defensive. That is so good. Hey, Max, we need you to get after Phillip Rivers. Patrick Mahomes, Max, you got to get after it.
You've just listened to the best of the herd with Colin Cowherd. Please tune in tomorrow for more of Colin Cowherd right here.